Welcome to the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Today, we are going to talk about how to know what kind of deals are available in the student loan refinancing market based off of what's going on in the economy. So I got this idea because of one of our reader questions. So this reader said the following. He said, "Hey, Travis, I'm trying to decide if I should go ahead and pull the trigger on refinancing my private student loans, or should I wait to see if the Fed lowers its federal funds rate?" And therefore, you're wondering, he's basically said he's wondering what range of student loan refinance rates are available based off of what's going on in the economy and what the Federal Reserve is doing. So for those of you that don't know, the Federal Reserve is this fancy group of economists that are appointed by the president. They get together and they basically figure out what rates are going to be for borrowing. And they can do all kinds of stuff broader than that, but they really have a big impact on what interest rates are in the economy. So this reader goes on to say, "I know that mortgage rates are kind of pegged to the yield on 10-year treasury bonds," which that's basically what the government borrows money from investors for a 10-year period of time, what interest rate they have to pay to borrow from investors for a 10-year period of time. So he goes on and says, "Even if the Federal Reserve keeps lowering its federal funds rate, does that mean that mortgage rates also go down? What about student loan refinance rates? Are they pegged to anything? Or is it the case where whenever the Fed lowers interest rates, does that also lower my student loan rates?" So I thought that was a really great question. And I thought that we would kind of broaden that question just to talk about like what happens to student loan refinancing rates based off of what's going on in the economy at large. And that's actually a really good question. It's a really good thing to think about. So in episode 42 of the Student Loan Planner Podcast, which you can find by going to studentloanplanner.com/42, we talk about the refinancing ladder. This is the concept where you start off with a long-term refi term, like a 20-year, because of the lower payment that it gives you on your student loans. And you do that, even though you have a low required payment, you pay way more than that. And you knock down the size of your loan balance, which allows you to refinance again to a shorter repayment term, such as a 10 or a 15-year. So when you pay down a lot of your loan balance by making extra big prepayments, what that does is it actually lowers your amount that you owe, which makes a 15-year payment potentially maybe around the same amount of money as you started off with on a 20-year term for a lot larger loan balance. So if you think about how this would work, you know, you think, okay, you got $200,000, you refi with a 20-year term, and then maybe you pay down that amount to 150 and you refinance to a 15-year term, the payment might kind of be roughly the same. But the interest rate will be lower, and all the while you kept yourself from having a payment that's really high that could basically get in the way of doing things that are really important in your life, like buying a house, starting a family, buying a business, things like that. So a refi ladder is you start off at the top rung of the ladder with a 20-year or 15-year term, something that gives you a really low payment, and then you step down the ladder and refinance multiple times. So you go to maybe from a 20-year to a 10-year, and then you go from a 10-year to a 5-year, and then maybe you go from a 5-year fixed to a 5-year variable with the last step down the ladder. So that gives you cashback refinancing bonuses if you go through studentloanplanner.com/refi, R-E-F-I, studentloanplanner.com/refi. So if you go through that link and you refi with a, and you have to use a new email address, by the way, otherwise you might not be, you know, tagged correctly if you've already applied to these places, but use a new email address to apply and you get these cashback bonuses all the way down. Is that a big deal? No, the main thing that matters is the interest cost and the payment rate and the quality of the customer service and things like that. But everybody else on the internet loves to get lots and lots of money for refinancing without giving you a darn thing. So we take a lot of the money out of our refinancing, basically affiliate commissions, so that you can get those cashback bonuses. So really, really appreciate it when you share those with your friends because it costs a lot of money to do that. And whenever somebody shares it with their friends, it reminds me that it's worth it to do that. So really appreciate that. When you're talking about doing like a refi ladder, so I wanted to go into like what the refi market is like just before we get into like how the economy impacts what rates are offered to you. So different lenders give you different deals. So one lender might be a bank, right? One lender might be kind of funded through investors that have to go out on Wall Street and get raise money to basically fund these deals. Other lenders still might be wanting to package this up and sell it. Other lenders might want to hold this all on their own balance sheet. And so that means different lenders have different kind of desires for different kinds of loans. So for example, one lender might be really, really good in 20 years, right? They might love long-term student loan, you know, refinancings. They might really like the 15 or the 20 year. And so they'll offer special rates in that fixed 15 and 20 year rate so that they'll attract more business because, you know, obviously people are shopping for the lowest rate. So the lowest rate will usually win. Now, another lender might have a strong preference for short-term debt. Maybe that lender really likes the idea of five-year loans, likes getting the idea of getting paid back fast. So in that case, maybe another lender is really good with five-year variable rates. And so for that reason, that's another reason this refi ladder kind of works is because if you can lock in a super low rate for the long term, and then you can refinance it once you've reduced some of the principal, so you reduce your risk of the things that can go wrong when you refi to a more aggressive payment, that allows you to save money on interest and it saves you money all the way down paying it off. I've got a little fun personal story for you. We actually started off with a five-year variable rate when we refinanced my wife's medical school loans. So the reason we did that is because we're pretty confident that we were not going to get any PSLF forgiveness because so many mistakes were made with managing her loans that it was pretty much the end of the road. We refinanced to a five-year variable for a couple reasons. Her debt to income ratio, basically her debt as it related to the size of her income was about 0.5. So she made about twice as much as she owed in debt. For that reason, we knew that we could pay off that student loan in probably a couple of years if we absolutely had to. The interest rate that we were offered, I think it was like a 3.5% for a fixed rate and then maybe like 2.2% variable. So we ended up going with a 2.2% variable interest rate. And that worked out, but that variable rate went up. So it rose from like 2.2 to 2.7. Once it rose to about 2.7, we decided to refinance it again. The thing that really motivated her to do it was actually not the lower interest rate that she could get because the lower interest rate was pretty modest. It was the cashback bonus. So we refied again and she got the $500 cashback bonus. She said, well, I'm only going to do it if I get to use that $500 to buy like this pair of, you know, fancy boots that she's always wanted. And so I thought, okay, cool. We save money on interest. She gets some money to buy something that she's really wanted for a long time. And so it kind of worked out. Now, some of you ask me a lot, what happens about your credit score when you refinance? Like, is that a bad thing? Like, should you be really concerned about that when you refi? And so I would tell you this, I would say I would not be concerned about your credit score one bit from refinancing. The thing that's going to hurt you with refinancing is not the credit score. It's going to be what payment that you have. We refinanced and we still churned credit cards, right? We still applied all these credit cards. We got Southwest cards. And this is a fun little hack as a quick aside from talking about refinancing. Did you know that you can get like a business card from Southwest and a regular card and you can get the bonuses for the miles for those? And if you can get up to over 100,000 miles in airline miles, then Southwest gives you a companion pass. Basically, it's buy one, get one free on all airfare for, I think if you get it in the winter, then it's for really about 2 years. So it's a really cool benefit. And we got that even though we had been refinancing a whole lot. So the credit score really only matters if it's really low. Like, yeah, then 5 or 10 points in your credit score can matter a lot. But if your credit score is already in like the 700s, then I don't think refinancing should matter with your credit score really one hill of beans. I think it's just a very minor thing. The credit score, like I said, at most is a, you know, small hit to the credit score and it recovers within a few months. So it's really not something that you should really worry about. The thing that you do need to worry about is in terms of how much of a monthly payment that you're committing yourself to. If we had needed a mortgage around that time, it actually would not have mattered too much. The only catch is we could have ended up impacting what we would qualify for a mortgage by doing a 5 year instead of doing like a 10 or a 15 or a 20 year because the payment is much, much higher in a 5 year loan than it is for a 10 or 15 or 20 year loan. To give you some more illustrations of this, the thing that matters, like I said, is your acquired payment. That's what impacts things. This is a problem that happens that we've seen many times with refinancing. So you come out of school and you read some blog that's super amped about refinancing. It's like, this is the thing that's going to get you out of debt. Like refi today and get so much less interest and start paying your loan back in no time at all. You deserve lower costs and you're going to get out of debt so fast. And so they kind of draw you in with this, right? And like I said, for people that don't know, everything on the internet that you click is probably somewhat ad supported, at least at some level. Either you have an article that's trying to funnel you down to do a certain action, like subscribe for a email list or sign up for a course or a mastermind group or a paid service or something like that. Or there's just these links on the page that you click and the website gets money if you click on those pages. So that's a huge moneymaker for websites in the student loan refinancing market. And so one thing that I love about our company is that we can make money giving people unbiased advice, and we can also make money on student loan refinancing and private loans and things like that. We have a very strong incentive to keep our reputation intact, which means that we always want to try to give the best advice. And I like the idea of minimizing conflicts of interest by giving the higher cashback bonus, which means we make less money, so we're less tempted to tell you to do something when it's not the right thing to do. Meanwhile, like some of the people that write articles for us tell us that some of the other employers they've worked for basically said, we don't care what you write as long as the solution is refinance your student loans, right? Or the solution is take out a private student loan. So that's really bad for the reader. It's really bad for the person that's reading the content and consuming the content. So hopefully you kind of see that with us, that we're a little different and trying to look out for your interests. Not going to pretend that there's not any conflicts of interest, because that just wouldn't be true for anything. There's always conflicts in some level, but want to make sure that you only do something if it's absolutely the right thing to do for your situation. So here's an example. So you do a 5-year loan, and let's say your payment is $10,000 a month required of you. So there's this thing called front-end debt-to-income ratio and back-end debt-to-income ratio. And no, it has nothing to do with front-end or back-end, or I don't know, that's just a term they choose, okay? Front-end debt-to-income ratio, that's a term that's used when they're trying to qualify you for a house. So for example, let's say that you're going to your mortgage broker, you're looking online, and you're trying to figure out what kind of house you could qualify for. So one of the things that they're going to do is they're going to look at your income, and they're going to say the very maximum front-end debt-to-income ratio that we're going to approve somebody for is, let's say it's 28% or 30% or something like that. So as a general rule, then what that would mean, a front-end debt-to-income ratio is this. You take the annual housing cost that you're trying to pay on your mortgage, and then you divide that by your income, and that's your front-end debt-to-income ratio. So that number historically needed to be below 28%, but because the economy is doing really well, they're being a lot looser with that, and they're letting people buy houses that have a much higher front-end ratio than that. All right, so that's one way that you can get denied for a house. If you're looking to buy a house that costs $40,000 a year and you make $100,000, then that's a front-end debt-to-income ratio of 40%. You're going to get denied probably. Now, there's this thing called back-end debt-to-income ratio that can also prevent you from getting a house or a business or a lot of things. And this is what it kind of means. Pretend for a moment that you have $2,000 a month of housing costs that you want to sign up for, and you've got $1,000 of other debt. So this is including student loans, a car loan, etc. So that means that your annual debt costs are about $36,000 a year. And if you're making $100,000, then your back-end debt-to-income ratio is 36%. Back-end debt-to-income ratio, you can think of that as absolutely everything that you owe every month, annualized, divided by your annual income. All right, that is the way that they determine this back-end debt-to-income ratio. Now, if you sign up for a student loan, in that earlier example, you have $2,000 of housing, $1,000 of other debt, so $3,000 total. If you sign up for, let's say that's for the 10-year term, if you signed up for the 5-year term for that student loan, then that other debt category of payments per month, instead of $1,000 a month, let's say it's $2,000 a month. So suddenly $2,000 of housing plus $2,000 of non-housing debt every month is $4,000 a month times 12 is $48,000. So if you look at the $48,000 divided by $100,000, then that back-end debt-to-income ratio is 48%. You know, a lot of the mortgage lenders out right now are approving back-end debt-to-income ratios as like around 43%, apparently. So 43% is kind of considered a decent back-end debt-to-income ratio. Now, you can maybe even go higher than that, particularly if you're a physician or a dentist or somebody like that. But if you think about the back-end debt-to-income ratio, that's how people could potentially sabotage their goals by signing up for too aggressive of a student loan refi without even realizing it. So that's why I tell people, you know, if you do the refi, you might start with a 15 or the 20 year just to keep your payment low so that you can qualify easily for whatever mortgage or business loan that you want to qualify for. You know, the front end ratio is 28%. The back end ratio is 36%. This is according to the truthaboutmortgage.com. And more recently, this back end ratio has risen to about this 43% number that I mentioned. Now, again, if you have some sort of professional medical kind of degree, a lot of these banks will just really loosen the purse strings and give you even more than that. Okay, but that is how people can really screw up their ability to get a mortgage on the terms that they want. It's not because of the credit score at all. The credit score might be fine, but your required payment towards debt might be very large, in which case that the underwriter at the mortgage company is not going to want to approve you for that reason. Now, here's the strength of income-driven repayment programs for people that are trying to qualify for a mortgage that are not refinancing. The strength of it is if you're on an IDR program, then the bank basically, for most government-backed mortgages, which is the majority of the market, they have to basically include your IDR payment instead of 1% of your principal like they used to. So for somebody with a $400,000 debt, they used to say, we assume that you have to pay $4,000 a month. And so that would make your back end debt to income ratio super high. And then suddenly you would not be qualifying for a business loan, a mortgage, a lot of things. But what they did instead is they started looking at the specific IDR payment. And that might only be $500 a month. And so suddenly somebody's back end debt to income ratio could be super, super high. But then when you account for income driven repayment, it could be very low and it could actually make you qualify for whatever loan that you want to take out. This is a fun little tidbit of information. So these companies called Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, so they are the big sort of government sponsored mortgage companies, and they're involved with a whole bunch of mortgages in America. So I'm not a mortgage expert or specialist, and I don't want to pretend to be, but these are things that you need to think about when you're trying to buy a house. So since those big corporations kind of determine a lot of who gets a mortgage and who doesn't, then you do want to try to follow their underwriting guidelines of having that back-end debt-to-income ratio below 43% if you want to qualify. Another cool little tidbit is this applies for businesses too. If you've committed yourself to too large of a student loan payment, then a bank or another lender that wants to give you money to start your own practice might not want to do that. So that's a big concern. So for those of you who want to refinance and want to do that before you become a practice owner, then you want to try to do that 20-year term to keep that required payment as low as you can, because that's going to prevent your debt-to-income ratio, your payment on your debt-to-income ratio, to be from being too high where you're not going to get approved. And here's some good news. Say that you decide to refi to a 5-year term later, after you buy your house, after you buy your practice, or whatever that you want to do, start a family. They cannot take away your mortgage just because you go over that debt to income ratio later. So in other words, if you get the mortgage in place, you buy the business loan or whatever you need to do, get the business loan, then you could go ahead and go out there and make a super aggressive refi, and that's totally fine. It won't affect anything. Because again, they're not able to do underwriting after the fact and stop you from having that mortgage just because of that decision that you made. So that's a great reason why you want to be a little careful going shorter than a 15 or a 20 year refinancing term if you're looking at buying a house or starting a business. And just so you know, if you did sign up for a 5-year term and you're regretting it, right now is a great time to undo that. So the way you can undo it is you cannot go back to federal loans, but what you can do is you can refinance the 5-year loan to a longer term at a higher interest rate, believe it or not. So just because you're signing up for a longer term with a higher interest rate doesn't mean you're blocked from doing that. You can still do that, even though it kind of seems like it's kind of crazy. You've already got this low interest rate. Why would you refi? Well, again, I've had people get denied mortgages because they went with too aggressive of a refinancing terms. That's what I want to try to prevent for you. So to get to the crux of this episode, I wanted to set that stage so that you just understand some of the context for refinancing and the refi ladder and all these different concepts. This is the first thing that you need to know about refinancing when they base the fixed rates for refinancing based off of what the government is borrowing at, plus some sort of extra interest for factoring in the credit risk of you not paying the people back. So what does that mean? What are the interest rates right now? So right now, The interest rates for the government to borrow are some of the most ridiculous that I've ever seen in my life. I used to be a bond trader, so I used to think about this all the time, every day, and now we're in this world where rates are just stupidly low, and you just wonder, how long can this last? I didn't think it would ever last this long, and it has. So you just got to go with the world you live in and just try to figure it out, right? So here's some of the examples of the interest rates that are currently being offered. So here's some of the rates that are currently available that the government borrows at. So this is as of kind of October when I recorded this. So, you know, rates go up and down and change all the time. So this might be very different by the time this episode releases. 5-year, 1.36%. 7-year, 1.45%. 10-year, 1.54%. 15-year, about 1.7%. And then 20-year, about 1.8%. What that means is that the government can literally borrow money for 10 years and pay interest of about 1.54%. That is super, super low. And you might ask the question, well, why the freaking heck is my interest on my student loan sitting here at 6% or 7%? Why is it not sitting down at 3% or 4% if the government's able to borrow at 1.5%? That's a great question. And, you know, one of the big risks, frankly, to student loan planner is that at some point the government might just say, screw it, let's just set all the interest rates on student loans to 2%. Then our refinancing business kind of goes away. And then, you know, people maybe don't need as much help because, you know, it's a low interest rate. People are just not worried about it anymore. I mean, if that happens, yippee, you know, we'll probably try to get into something else. I'll probably try to sell flowers in a street corner in Key West or something. I don't know, making stuff up, trying to make sure that you're still awake, still listening. But if it doesn't, then the current world will keep on going, which is probably more likely. You've got basically 1-something% available to the government at almost all these different term levels. What happens is, on top of that, you have to add an extra yield for investors to be incentivized to lend to you instead of to the government. So let me make a little example of this. I've got a deal for you. You can lend to the government and get paid 1.5% interest, or you can lend to your neighbor at 1.5% interest. Who would you rather lend to? Obviously, you're going to want to lend to the government because the government is far more likely to pay you back than the neighbor that lives next to you. And the same thing is true for anything that investors are thinking about putting their money in. So this is a little world into the world of bonds. So hopefully this is not too specific, but I hopefully think that you'll really enjoy this just so you could learn a little bit more about something that you might not be aware of. There's these different kind of rated corporate bonds. Corporate bonds start off at AAA and then they kind of go down in their credit quality. And then basically the rating agencies try to assign a risk to these bonds. So basically say, like, we think that they'll default this much percent of the time at this level of rating. So then investors can appropriately look at those bonds and decide, like, how much interest they need to get paid to buy them. So for example, the lowest investment grade bond is a BBB bond. BBB bonds default about 0.3% of the time, according to efficientfrontier.com. So they don't really default very often. And in February of this year, investors wanted about 1.1% more money to put their money in the BBB bonds instead of the government bonds. So if the government bonds are yielding 1.5, then those BBB bonds that are corporate companies that are issuing debt, you know, an investor would have to earn like 2.6 to put their money in that instead. In the current environment in October, the investors won about 1.6% more in yield to put their money into these corporate riskier bonds than to put it with the government. So instead of 1.5, you'd add 1.5 plus 1.6, and that's 3.1% for a 10-year bond. Credit risk in the economy is a little bit more elevated now than it was back in February. So that makes sense because there's been a lot of noise about trade wars and China and just the stock market being overvalued and WeWork being a kind of a not legitimate thing, you know, or a super overvalued company. People a little bit more worried. And so whenever people are more worried, investors want more return for putting their money into something that's not the government, which is super safe. So what could happen with student loan refinancing rates that could hurt you? So in a recession, people get spooked. People start remembering that there's a risk that when they lend, people won't pay them back. And whenever there's recessions, then this spread can really get quite large. So in 2011, it's been a little while, but people were fearful that we might be going into another recession. And so that spread of what investors asked for to lend money to risky companies was an extra 3% over the cost of lending to the government. If you look at the rates that, you know, are given to high qualified student loan borrowers, what ends up happening is basically investors tend to ask for about 1% more money, giving money to student loan borrowers rather than somewhat risky companies. So investors think even the very well qualified borrower is a little bit higher risk than putting money in corporate bonds. This could be true for a number of reasons. Maybe people just are more familiar with corporate bonds, like student loan refinancing is a little bit uncertain for big money investors. So the only people that are putting money in it right now are just random banks, private equity investors, people like that. So in 2008, this is how the refinancing market would explode and sort of stop working. So these numbers are according to the St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank. So in 2008, the spread of how much extra yield investors wanted to get to put their money into corporate bonds was basically 8%. So in other words, you know, if you take, say, the government's borrowing at 2%, risky companies would have to borrow at 10% to make investors want to buy them. So obviously, if you have interest rates at like 10%, then add 1% for what the rate would be for student loan borrowers, then that means the refi market would totally have disappeared in 2008. Like, it didn't really exist back then. Most all these companies came about after 2008, so they've never been tested by a severe recession in terms of, are they going to still offer good rates during the recession? Not in terms of whether or not you'll still be able to pay them back at the same interest rate that you borrowed at. That's a guarantee. That's contractual. You don't have to worry about that. I'm talking about, could you get a new refi deal out in an environment that was a recession? So in 2002, that was another recession, and the spread extra yield that basically investors wanted to get for putting money in risky stuff back then was like 3.5%. So imagine a government bond yielding 2%, then add 3.5% during a recession, that's 5.5%, plus another percent for just lending to an individual instead of a company. So now in a recession, you might be up to 6.5% for a student loan borrower to refinance. Would that kill the refinance market? Well, it would kill probably 80% of it during those periods of time where everybody's afraid of risk, but it wouldn't completely eliminate it. If you had 2008 happen again, refinancing would, like I said, totally go away, at least for a few years until markets calmed down enough that investors were willing to lend to individuals again, you know, at attractive rates. So right now, 10-year fixed rates for the best qualified borrowers are around 4% for some lenders. So like I said, you know, if the government's borrowing at 1.5, that means that investors are asking for an extra 2.5% to put their money in student loans instead of the government. Now, you can put your money into a corporate bond at maybe like 3%, like a somewhat risky corporate bond at 3%. So in my opinion, that's a very large mispricing. So the only reason why you'd be really worried about student loan refinancing is because you haven't seen really good numbers about how people pay student loan refinanced loans during a recession. You don't really have a lot of data to go off of there, what the real default rates would be during a recession. But my estimate is that it'd be very low, because we try to make sure that the only people that refinance their loans are people that are really financially secure, know they want to get out of debt, want to lock in a lower interest rate and save money, right? It's people that really need to refinance anyway. And so, you know, in my view, there was a research paper that came out of Goldman Sachs that showed that people that have over 750 FICO scores, that's credit scores, rarely, if ever, default. So for people that are very highly qualified, you know, lending money to somebody at a pretty low interest rate, and then, you know, an investor buying that bond of somebody that's going to pay them back, I think that's a great deal. So I would kind of wonder, are they going to come out with mutual funds where you can invest in student loan refinancing at some point? It's kind of a new market, which is why I don't think they've done it in a big way. And a lot of people will look at the rates that are being offered for some refi companies, and they're basically saying like, well, you know, this is ridiculously low. Like, I don't want to put my money in something like, you know, 4% for 10 years or something to a student loan refinancing deal. Like, that seems like a bad deal. But it's not about what can I go earn in student loans is about what can I earn in student loans relative to something else. That's generally what drives investor behavior is if I'm getting 1.5% of my government bond, then the 4% loan for the student loan refinancing to the physician looks pretty freaking good to put your money in, doesn't it? I would anticipate that long-term interest rates will continue to fall in the student loan refinancing market in terms of, I think that the credit risk will be reduced because, you know, banks and investors and other places will realize that they've got this asset on their hands that basically people pay it back and they don't default. You know, for people that have lower FICO scores, like, yeah, there would be a bigger risk that those people will not pay the loan back. And so for that reason, that's why not everybody gets, you know, an amazing 4% rate in 10 years when they refinance. That's why some people, they get a 4.5, they get a 5, they get a 5.5, a 6. It depends on your credit score and it depends on how much cash you have available to pay down your student loan. In some cases, some companies will actually even take into account your savings. They'll even look at what you have saved up and they'll look at if that makes you a better borrowing candidate or not. So for example, you can go to studentloanplanner.com/earnest. We have the $500 cashback bonus with them. They look at your savings rate and they look at how much you have saved up and they use that in addition to your FICO score to help you get a lower rate that way. So if you hate 10-year treasuries and you hate the yields that are available on government bonds right now from an investment standpoint, then you know maybe there really needs to be some sort of student loan refi index fund. And if there ever was, boy, oh boy, would rates be able to come down a lot more. This already exists for mortgages. There's like mortgage-backed securities. Anybody who hears mortgage-backed securities or MBS just freaks out because you think of 2008, the thing that almost brought the world economy down was bad mortgage-backed securities. But if you think about that, that's stuff that was super risky. You know, super risky. It was super leveraged. It was all these derivatives, people betting on all this stuff. That's not what we're talking about here. We're just talking about a market that's a lot smaller than mortgages of people that are very highly qualified credit risks that just want lower interest rates than what the government offers. Anyway, so a good way to predict what fixed student loan interest rates are in the economy is to add 2 to 3% to the 10-year treasury yield, and that's probably the range you can expect. And you can do that for the 20-year yield, the 5-year yield, etc. So for example, the 5-year treasury bond, I said yielded like 1.35, so add maybe 2, you could expect, you know, 3.35% that's available in the economy. And then, you know, for a 10-year yield, you might add 2.5%, it's kind of in between that range of 2 to 3, and so that gets you to 4%. And then for the 20-year yield, maybe you take your, you know, your 1.8% that the government's borrowing at, and then you add 2.75 to 3% to that, and you could expect yields of like 4.6 something to 4.8 for a 20-year fixed rate. So that's a really good rule of thumb, is just to add 2 to 3% on top of what the government's borrowing at. And that's how you'll know what the interest rates are in the student loan refi market. So the only way that would change is if we had a really bad recession or if we had a really bad inflation. So either one of those things would cause interest rates to rise on student loan refi. So that was a lot about fixed rates, but what about variable rates? For variable rates, we like using those. My wife and I like using those when we were knowing that we wanted to pay down our debt really fast. It's because you can get a rate that starts with a 2 if it's a variable rate. So some of the rates right now are like 2.14, something like that for a 5-year variable. That's super low. And yes, that will increase. But if that rate increases at a level slower than, you know, getting to your fixed rate offer, like so say your fixed rate offer is 3.3 and your variable rate's 2.1, well, that rate could rise quite a bit and you would still save money on that, especially if you're paying down the loan really fast. So if you're going to use a variable rate loan, you want to try to get an interest rate at least 1% below the fixed, and you want to try to be able to pay it down in 2 or 3 years if you absolutely had to. And how would you figure out what rates are on a variable rate loan? So it's based off of this short-term statistic called 30-day LIBOR. So golly, that's, I hope I'm not losing you, right? 30-day, what the heck does 30-day LIBOR mean? That sounds like a, I don't know, like a malignant tumor or something, 30-day LIBOR. So that's basically short-term interest rates in the economy, which is heavily influenced by what the Federal Reserve does. So as a general rule, if you have a variable rate loan, if the Federal Reserve raises interest rates, your rate's probably going to go up. If the Federal Reserve cuts interest rates, your rate will probably go down. Also, whenever the Federal Reserve lowers interest rates, the rate on your savings account that you have with your bank will probably also go down. So in other words, variable rates, they can go up or down. Remember that. They can do both. In general, the variable rates, you know, the statistic that they use to raise or lower the variable rate, it's not super volatile usually. You know, I mean, like a lot of people think, oh my gosh, it's going to go up like 3% one day. And that's just, that doesn't happen unless there's some sort of severe economic crisis. Okay. And so that's why I say if you had to, you want to be able to pay that loan down back really fast if you really needed to. But in general, that's not something you should worry about. So we're really, really high short-term rates in the economy. We had this thing called yield curve inversion, which means that the short-term borrowing costs more than the long-term borrowing. And so because of the fact that variable rates are based off of short-term interest rates, we were seeing variable rates that were just not competitive at all. Like variable rates were awful in the past few months. But what happened is the short-term rates started falling. People became a little bit more worried about recession. Federal Reserve started being a little bit more cautious about having really high short-term rates. And so now we're seeing a comeback of some of these really low variable rates back when we refinanced my wife's student loans about 3 years ago. So the long-term rates going up or down, like your 30-year mortgage rates going up or down, actually didn't really have an impact on your variable student loan. It just, again, it's based off of what the short-term interest rates are in the economy that's mostly influenced by what the Federal Reserve does. So what's interesting right now is sometimes variable rates are really attractive and fixed rates are not that great. Sometimes fixed rates are really attractive and variable rates are not that good. Right now, both of them are really attractive. So right now, like tons of people are applying to refinance a lot more than average because of how low rates have gotten and how competitive some of the lenders are getting with trying to compete over business. So if you go to studentloanplanner.com/refi, you know, we try to curate the best deals at the very top of the page so that we don't put all of the lenders that we have available up there. We only put the ones that most people end up using. So you want to apply to at least probably the ones that we list on the table. You know, you're probably going to find some really shockingly good deals if you haven't applied in a while. And remember that you can refinance more than one time. You don't need to refi once and then you're done. You can refinance as many times as you want, so long as you can get a better rate. And again, anybody who's refinanced in the past 3 years right now, if you haven't applied recently, probably could get a better rate. And so again, if you just want to get that cashback bonus, you just have to make sure you apply through that student loan planner link and you got to use maybe a new email address just to make sure you're tagged right. So at some point, there's going to be a recession. And the thing that makes me a little worried is that a lot of the people that have used or refinancing links and have refinanced are going to regret refinancing. And that's something I think about all the time. And that's why I try to make sure that if you refi, you have an emergency fund, you know what you're doing, you know what you're getting yourself into, you know you're going to pay down your debt really rapidly, and you feel good about that. But there will be some people that will regret it. And so that definitely has me a little worried when that happens. So I really want to be singing this song about focus on your savings, emergency fund, emergency fund, emergency fund. Don't sign up for a payment that's too much. You know, that's why the refi ladder makes sense. You start off with a payment that's pretty comfortable, and then you pay a lot extra and you refi again. What's going to happen in the next recession is if we have a recession that's not terrible, then refinancing will still be around, but you're not going to be able to get nearly as good deals as you can get today. And that's because, again, in recessions, people get afraid of people paying them back more. And so investors are going to ask to get more yield in exchange for giving people money so that they can refinance their loans and get lower rates. Should you be upset if you miss out on super low interest rates right now? The answer is no, because the right time to refinance for you is when you are ready and not before that. To refinance, you know, you need to have a payment that you're really comfortable with. You need to be able to have an emergency fund. You need to work in the private sector. And then if you have a spouse who has a lot of student loans, then it can become complicated sometimes as to what you should be doing based off of if they're going for something like public service loan forgiveness. But if you know for sure you need to pay off your debt, then yes, refinancing is a great thing to do. Just make sure that you can easily make the payment and that, you know, your job's pretty stable. You don't have a lot to worry about on that front because once you refinance, you cannot undo it. Some people right now are getting rates as low as 3.9% for 10 years fixed and like 4.3% fixed for 15 and 4.6% for 20 years, which is just totally nuts. So, I mean, I think that that's some of the lowest fixed rates I think I've ever seen. So would be something that's smart to do. To apply if you know you need to do it, studentloanplanner.com/refi, obviously feel free to reach out, podcast@studentloanplanner.com if you want to share what kind of deals you're getting. Do not do it if you need to go for loan forgiveness, right? If you owe more than 1.25 times your income, you work in a not-for-profit, you know that you need to go for loan forgiveness because you talked to us already, do not refinance. That's a terrible thing to do. But I just wanted to do this episode so you could kind of get a gauge of, okay, like I'm looking at what the government's borrowing at, add 2 or 3% on top of that, and that's what the refi deals are going to be. And right now the government's formula is that they set the margin for what student loan rates are when you go to school. I think it's like 3.6 and 4.6% above what the government borrows at. So the government puts a number on the extra yield that the student loan interest rates are. They put a little higher number than they probably should for people with really good credit. And it's probably a lot lower than what they should charge if the people had bad credit, honestly. So the government's basically creating the situation where you've got houses in a floodplain and houses on the top of the mountain. And the people at the top of the mountain are allowed to buy private insurance for flooding, which never happens. So they're going to get offered a super low rate. And the people that live in the floodplain are getting insured or basically given an interest rate by the government. And if they had to buy flood insurance in the private market, that would be way more expensive than the 6 or 7% they're getting offered. So that is why we have the student loan system that exists today, is partly because the government allows this to happen. We'll see what happens in the future with this. I can't predict the future, but I can predict that you'll save a lot of money by refinancing if you need to. So reach out to us. You can check out the show notes of today's show at studentloanplanner.com/48. And again, if you want to ask questions, if you want to ask a refinancing question, go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. We'd love to get a couple of those so we can try to clear some things up for you.